And we are back with another episode of Commonwealth Ground. Thank you all so much for sticking with us. We're glad to be back with another episode. We both had some crazy schedules, some technical difficulties that haven't had us put up an episode for a few weeks, but we have got so much to discuss this week, so we are glad to be back at it. If you're joining us for the first time, my name is Victoria. I am one of the co-hosts of the program. I'm a conservative journalist and commentator, and then my co-host Jackie Gary, she is a staffer in Richmond for a representative, and she is also very involved with Democrat politics in Northern Virginia and beyond. So if you're joining us for the first time, that's a little bit about us. And this week we are going to be discussing some great legislation that's come out of Richmond, going to be heading, has been passed in both chambers, and will be heading to Governor Glenn Youngkin's desk and seeing what he's going to do with some of that legislation, as well as an update on the presidential race on both the Republican and the Democrat side. And with that, I will turn it over to my co-host Jackie. She's going to update us on the first thing that we have coming out of Richmond. Very exciting. An update on some legislation related to skills games.
Hey, Victoria, it is great to be back with you. It has been a crazy few weeks down in Richmond during Virginia's legislative session, but we are going into the final 5 or 6 days as of recording this. We'll be adjourning how we call a sine die or sine die, depending on the chamber you're in, on this Saturday, March 9th. We are on the final week to cast votes on legislation to send to the governor's desk. And I kind of wanted to talk about two of the biggest ones that have been generating a lot of conversation around Richmond. We've talked a lot about the third, which is the arena in Alexandria, but I figured we'd give some updates on some of the other stuff that we're looking at. So, one of those, as you mentioned, is skill games for our listeners who may or may not know. These are the games in your convenience stores that you can play. They're called skill games. Some people call them, you know, gray machines or slot machines. Kind of relate them to gambling. It's not really what it is at all. These are games that you do have the ability to alter the outcome for and generate revenue. And they became really big during the pandemic in our convenience stores and became a major source of revenue for a lot of small business owners that allowed them to keep their doors open and allowed them to increase wages, hire more employees during a really, really difficult time. But they've been called gray machines because they've been in this kind of like legal gray area for a while, whether people weren't sure whether they were allowed or illegal. And so the marketplace kind of exploded for this and has been kind of like a really unregulated market. And so the General Assembly has been working this year to set up a regulatory market so that these things can continue to exist in convenience stores, but also kind of have some oversight and regulation so that they're not quite as out of hand as they are now. And so a compromise was finally reached this week and voted on and passed and is heading to the governor's desk. That would set up a market that would cap the number of machines allowed in each store and generate revenue and tax structure. So that is what kind of the baseline of those machines are. And so it's very good to me to see kind of having some regulation put in place on these things and allow the state to generate some tax revenue.
I love it. Again, as somebody that is definitely more on the conservative end of things politically, you know, as a proud Republican, most days at least, I don't agree with many taxes, but kind of the taxes that make the most sense to me are really use taxes. And so I think if there is a revenue that can be generated for the government in ways that are not burdensome on people kind of doing their daily activities, but are something extra, whether that's things like sin taxes, which we'll probably talk about in our next bit when we talk about marijuana, or, you know, things like these skills games. You know, it's extra spending that people are doing that isn't necessarily kind of something that they have to be doing every day, but it's something that is pleasurable, but also increases revenue for small businesses. I'm not sure if this is actually one of the episodes that we had go up or not, or if this is one of the ones we had some issues with, but I talked about how I've seen the impact of these slot machine, or not slot machines, because it's not gambling, these skills games. But they look like slot machines. So again, I understand what some of the confusion comes up with or comes from. But for me, you know, I've seen them in gas stations and 7-Elevens and just neighborhood convenience stores all over where I spend my days. There's a, we call it, it's like a little market that's in an apartment building a few buildings away from my own. And I think several apartment complexes in the area have people, they'll go and they'll get, you know, little sodas and snacks and things. And before, when I used to walk in there, I'd say towards the end of the pandemic and probably for the year or two afterwards until these kind of got shut down, was, you know, there'd probably be five or six people sitting in there most times that I would go in there on these gaming apparatuses. And then now when I walk in there, it's like pretty much dead. And I'm sure that those small businesses that barely survived the pandemic and really kind of hung on to this as a sort of lifeline, I'm sure they've probably been generating less revenue since these machines were shut down. So, you know, I think if there's an avenue, anything that we can do to make lives easier for small businesses, again, if it's, you know, spending that people are already willing to do, if there's, you know, again, a little bit that the government can take from that, that, again, I don't think really impacts people's day-to-day lives, but it's something that's additional that they're going on about, you know, I'm pretty okay with it, and I'm excited to see the legislature take this up. And, you know, I'm hoping that the governor signs it, because, again, I think small businesses would be pretty appreciative, really all around the area. Again, I'm not sure how common what I've seen in my own neighborhood is around the rest of the state, but I know that this is something that's pretty small, but it's something that I've noticed. And so with that, I
mean, again, it really is like a big deal. We've been visited all session long by small business owners around the Commonwealth who have been talking about the exact things that you brought up here, about how kind of how the gray area has really impacted and hurt their business. And so I really hope the governor signs it. I know he's expressed some concerns about the legislation, but I hope that concern is addressed through like amendments to the legislation that people can agree upon and vote for versus a straight veto. Because I do think it's really important. And I don't think, you know, I've heard people have concerns about, you know, gambling and everything. And I definitely share those concerns, even though this isn't gambling, I understand like where the concern comes from. But I think the like important thing to remember is that we have this huge body of evidence that criminalizing something doesn't actually stop addiction from occurring. It just further stigmatizes it and makes it harder for people to get treatment. And if you don't have a regulatory system, it just generates like a black market for this stuff. And so I think it is really important that we as a state recognize that like this is something that's going to happen whether we like say it is or not. And at the end of the day, if you put up regulations, you can get people who need help. And then for the people who it's not a problem for, they can enjoy these things and help promote our small businesses. And I think that's the really important part to remember.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think kind of as a conservative and as a Republican, you know, I think our party really loves to champion ourselves as a champion of small business. And so I think if the governor was to kind of ignore all those small business voices, I think it would stand pretty antithetical to a lot of what we believe in as, you know, members of the party that the governor and I both belong to. And so, yeah, you know, I think if there's anything that he's unhappy with, I think we'd much rather see him talk to the legislature than just really, you know, shut this down, or I guess keep shutting it down because it's already been shut down. But
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's a pretty good segue into something else that we see now being done underhanded and not being regulated and being really done, I think, in a way that is pretty indicative of basically being a black market, which is marijuana. You know, this is another legislation that we're seeing come to the governor's desk in the next couple of days. And unfortunately, he has indicated that I have the exact quote here. So the quote from a news outlet called Marijuana Moment. So it seems to me that they track most weed-related legislation across the country. The headline from them, which we will have linked in show notes for those that are interested, is, quote, Virginia GOP governor still doesn't have, quote, any interest, end quote, in signing marijuana sales bill as Democratic legislature approves plan. You know, I understand that a lot of Republicans, especially those that are older, have had issues with weed for a long time. But I think this is a split that many people in the Republican Party that are my age and even younger, I think we really see this as a generational split. I think most people around my age, regardless of party, know people that use this and have really experienced either through, you know, people in their own network or have heard dozens, if not hundreds, of stories about how this helps people and is, you know, helps them, and it's more good than harm, despite what we see from a lot of older legislators in our party, which is kind of the opposite, is that they think it causes more harm than good. You know, kind of for my own personal reasons for why I think the governor should sign it, even though according to at least this one headline, it doesn't really seem like he would. You know, obviously federally, federally, marijuana is still criminalized. And so obviously that prevents a lot of things like banking. But I think, again, I've seen in among my circles and people that I know of, it can do them more good than any potential dangers. I think kind of some of my reservations about opening up the marijuana market in Virginia probably would come from, again, just the fact that these businesses would really be forced into a sort of black market. Obviously, in places like DC, it's already exists through initiative. I believe it's Initiative 71. It's the quote unquote like gifting protocol. So, you know, I've heard from people that partake in these activities that, you know, it's you go in and you buy a quote unquote sticker and you get gifted the marijuana. And, you know, the sticker costs like 30 or 60 or however many dollars you're paying for whatever weight of product you're getting, right? And so at least in Northern Virginia, like, I'm sure that people use it all the time. Again, like, even being a Republican, obviously, I think the governor has done a lot of great things, but I think one of the really stupidest things that he's done while he's been governor is banning sales of Delta 8, because again, you know, I think it's some small businesses that were set up around this and they had to shut down, really shut their doors. Like, I know in the neighborhood that I live in South Arlington, there was these weed and vape stores popping up all over the place. And again, you know, they've been impacted very heavily by this. And, you know, obviously it's an industry that people invested in knowing that there would be some risk, but just, I think the way that some of these things are marketed where they're like, oh, it's a, you know, it's a glass spoon. And it's like, we all know that it is what it's used for, right? Like, the people that know, they know. And so this is just one of those instances where I just wish government would get out of the way. And I wish the governor would sign it, even though that's probably not what's going to happen. Another thing that I want to point to is that these discussions are happening in states that are even way more conservative than Virginia. That same outlet that I mentioned, that Marijuana Moment, you know, they also talk about like medical marijuana being considered in states like Kansas, and even the Republican Senate president there is willing to have the discussion, which I think, again, is a show of really how this issue, it really, I don't think, should have the partisan divide that it does, and really shouldn't be split as heavily one party versus the other as we're seeing here in our own state in Virginia.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And to your point about like the federal government, even, you know, as recently as like mid-January, there are conversations happening that might see marijuana rescheduled as a Schedule One drug to Schedule Three, which is the schedule that kind of it shows that there's less risk for abuse. There is a currently accepted medical use in treatment and a low risk or moderate physical dependence. And so it's not to say that rescheduling it will fully decriminalize it, but it will certainly put the federal government on the path to doing so and make it not as big a penalty. And then I think the other thing that really kind of like strikes me about this conversation, and you're right, I think it has become really partisan where it shouldn't be. And I wonder if like this is an argument that you feel Republicans could get behind. But I see like one of the things about not just decriminalizing, but really like regulating a sales market is that I think it would just be a really big step in the fight against fentanyl overdoses. I mean, because if you're taking a product where there's regulation and standards for growth and for growth and for sale, then you can make sure that there is a clean product out on the market. And you could see, you know, obviously weed is not the only thing that fentanyl gets laced with. And there is a lot of other uses where this could happen. But like, I see this as a potential for a huge decrease in overdose deaths by taking out people's dependency on a black market where there is a high prevalence for product being cut with fentanyl. Do you think that's like a viable argument to get Republicans on board with creating a sales market for this?
Well, that's an argument that resonates with me. Again, I think a lot of the resistance that you find to this is more generational mm-hmm. within the Republican Party itself, as I mentioned earlier. For me, like one of the things that I would, again, like of all the taxes that I'm most okay with are use taxes. And so, again, I think if the government is looking for a revenue source, I am much more okay with them finding it through something like sale of marijuana and just having it pretty heavily taxed, right? Like alcohol is already pretty heavily taxed. And, you know, mm-hmm. I think there's a full market even for like things like alcohol. I think at least in DC, like we've even seen there's, you know, cocktails that'll be sold as like CBD cocktails. And so I think there's a whole market of small businesses that we don't even really know about or haven't really discovered around this product that I think we could really open the gates for if it's decriminalized in a bunch of states and also, you know, federally as well for the banking issue, which again, I think for a lot of these small businesses is what they run into. Kind of some other reasons that I think Republicans should get on board with it that I'm surprised they haven't been, right? Like I think you mentioned it was one Republican in each chamber that actually sided with Democrats to pass the legislation. But for me, some arguments that I think are really effective within Republican ranks. One is that I know veterans and people with slight, you know, kind of mental issues that really rely on a lot of pharmaceutical drugs. When they try marijuana, a lot of the times it helps them get off of these other drugs. And I think, especially at a time when the Republican Party is very skeptical of things like big pharma, this is an alternative. You know, a lot of the times it's more natural. And again, like there's also a lot of products that are derivatives of marijuana that are already legalized, whether that's CBD, whether that's Delta 8, again, not in Virginia anymore, but in other states. And so, you know, even like recreational hemp, there's a lot of states that are using it in things like clothing, right? And so like if if this is being grown, like, you know, I think we should use as much of the plant as we can and use that to help as many people as we can. Again, definitely the fentanyl argument. And again, like if we do have this product and it's taxed, I think those monies can even be used to help things like, you know, people that have heavy narcotics addictions, right? Like if we want to use that money in something that's a parallel kind of issue, I would love for that money to be spent on that if it is taxed. Those are just kind of some of my thoughts about it. I think it's time for the Republican Party to get on board again. I think we have evidence of it happening in other states. And I think really every time that there is kind of an attempt to do something, more and more people do get on board with it. So,
yeah,
you know, unfortunately, if it doesn't happen this time, which it will probably not under Youngkin, you know, there's probably a chance to revisit it when more Republicans might be able to get on board with it.
Yeah. Well, I hope that, you know, you and all of our Republican listeners, I think, who agree with the setting up the market should really take this time, and especially this like last week of session, but also the couple weeks beyond it, while he's considering bills, to reach out and let him know why you as Republicans would like to see this go up. Because I do think that I do hope that hearing from folks from the same party will make an impact on him and maybe see his way to supporting legislation, or if he feels, again, the need to make amendments that could potentially be acceptable to the General Assembly, because we are kind of in this legal gray space again, where we've decriminalized it and there was supposed to be a market set up by this year. And there's not. And I don't really think that that's a state that Virginia can or really should exist in for too long.
No, I agree with that. Well, I guess when we're on the topic of things that I disagree with our Republican governor on, might as well plug the other one, which is the arena. Obviously, we talked even back in early January, where I was pretty skeptical of it. For anybody that didn't catch that episode, that's really the proposal that I think the governor and his team really wanted to be like his lasting legacy, which, at least from what I'm seeing, it will probably not be. I personally hope it won't be, which again, it sucks because he's kind of, I think, staked his claim on this as his key issue that he wants to get done as part of this year's budget, which is his legacy budget, as we've also discussed. It's the only budget that he gets to help craft, you know, sign into law when it's passed, and actually gets to be around for some of the implementation of it, since we do have one-term governors in Virginia. But I was part of a group of Northern Virginia Republican leaders that signed on to a letter urging the governor to not bring the arena to Potomac Yards. I signed on to that letter probably about a day or two after it was put up, but you know, it was myself, the Arlington GOP chair, Alexandria GOP chair, and then both the outgoing and the incoming 8th District Republican chair. And I think it's interesting because some other party leaders were like, why are you guys going against the governor on this? You know, you're supposed to kind of fall in line on this. And I think the exact words that we used, at least on the version of the letter that we republished on Republican Standard, which I'm an editor for, was that, like, we won't be bullied into this. Like, for us, you know, we don't really believe in this idea of crony capitalism. You know, we don't want billionaires to benefit from taxpayer dollars. We don't want any taxpayer dollars being spent on this project. And Andrew LaPosser, who's the current 8th District Republican chairman, he's the one that authored, at least as far as I know, he's the one that authored the bulk of the letter, along with Matt Hurt, who's the Arlington GOP chair. And, you know, in that letter, like, he cited some great studies by even like sports economists that say like this kind of thing actually doesn't really lead to like long-term jobs. It doesn't really help the area, and there's really no way to get this done with zero taxpayer investment up front, despite that being kind of the governor's big selling point. And so, yeah, you know, I think Andrew did a great job with that letter. I was personally happy to sign on to it, and hopefully it helps. You know, hopefully even if it does end up on his desk, hopefully it helps sway him to not sign it. But, you know, Jackie, you might have some insight on whether that will actually make it through the chamber. I think last time we talked, it was in one budget and not the other one, one chamber's budget, but not the other. But yeah, I don't know if you have anything to add on that, but that's, I guess, kind of my second soapbox for the episode is like, I really hope it doesn't happen.
You know, it's hard to say. I don't really know what's going to happen with the budget and if things are going to be taken out. That process is like the conference is pretty opaque, I guess, if you are not on the conference committee. I will say I think it has been made extremely difficult at this point for either side of the aisle to really support because of the labor community recently coming out against the project. Many labor unions have come out and said that there's not sufficient protections for union jobs in the project. And so I do think it'll be probably very difficult for even people who were kind of keeping an open mind at this point to really consider moving forward with this. But anything can change. My understanding is that even that is still kind of in negotiation. So maybe things are changed to that point, you know, with labor. But at this point in time, I don't know that I see it really happening.
Yeah, and again, I hope it doesn't happen, as I've made it very clear both back in January and now this week.
I mean, I'll say I'm a little disappointed that the labor negotiations ended up the way that did, because I think it could have been really beneficial and, you know, for labor. And, you know, I'll also add that I think looking at the space that's supposed to be kind of developed in this way, I have a hard time seeing what else could go there. Retail has been dying for 30 years, and Alexandria is currently leading the way in office, like in converting office space to apartments. And so I'm not really sure what people think is going to go there now. But at the same time, like to your point, I'm not really, if we're not getting this to a place where we're not just throwing money at billionaires and we're not creating well-paying jobs, then it's not really something that I feel like I could support either. So I find it kind of disappointing personally that the negotiations have gone this way, but also not willing to kind of cave on those points. So
yeah, I mean, even though I have been skeptical of the project since the beginning, like I, for example, can understand why they want to move these teams out of DC, because like I am definitely reluctant to go to some of these games and even like concerts and stuff in DC because of some of the issues that the city is facing. So like I understand kind of where the idea for this project came from, and I really do think that if it had been done in a more robust way, maybe again more involving some more stakeholders in the beginning, which like I think when we first talked about it, the governor's team and Monumental Sports and some other stakeholders in Alexandria directly did seem involved, and like they had a pretty robust plan at least to introduce the project. But I think that's kind of where the robustness of it ended, that like a lot of people still felt blindsided by it, which I think is important to note. Well, cool.
Yeah, so we'll see how they go, but I'm kind of skeptical at this point. But what have you been following? There's been a ton going on kind of federally and with the primaries, especially in Virginia, as we approach Super Tuesday, this Tuesday, March 5th. So what have you been seeing while following the primaries, Victoria?
Oh gosh, quite a bit. So obviously before this week, we had the South Carolina primary. That was kind of seen to be a big point for potentially Nikki Haley's campaign. Obviously, that was the state where she was governor. You know, she's had a lot of support in that state, but when we had those votes counted, so, you know, by the time this episode airs, it'll be airing Monday, so a week prior to when we had the, or I guess over a week, because the primary was on Saturday. So, yeah, I guess it's been 10 days in South Carolina when this episode airs. You know, Nikki Haley, I think, underperformed expectations. She got about 40% of the vote to Trump's 60% of the vote, but in the electoral delegate race, that means that she only took home 3 delegates out of 50 and Trump took home 47. So again, kind of when you look at the delegate race, Trump is winning that handedly. And I think a lot of people were expecting this to kind of be Haley's quote unquote like last stand before Super Tuesday, which is what we have this Tuesday. So again, by the time this episode airs, that'll be tomorrow. Obviously, she lost a pretty big supporter with Americans for Prosperity. That's the Coke-aligned group, for those that may not be familiar. They were supporting her campaign pretty heavily, lots of dollars invested. But again, for those that may not be very familiar with the Coke operation, endorsed candidates get to plug into a very involved network of grassroots activists. So, you know, that involves like smaller events, it involves door knocking. And so plugging a candidate into their operation, I mean, that's something that candidates really all levels want, is to have that infrastructure invested in their race. So she lost them. But on the flip side, actually, within the first 24 hours of losing her home state, she actually raised about $1 million still. So folks were still investing in her candidacy, which is interesting. This has been one of the bigger criticisms that the Haley team has faced from the Trump camp, is that at least the perception that the Trump camp has been trying to cast is that Haley has been funded by mega donors. And so the Koch network infusion of funds definitely helped strengthen the Trump camp's argument on that. And the Trump camp has been arguing that, you know, they're the campaign of the grassroots, and that's why Trump has been getting, you know, record numbers of grassroots donors, versus Haley's money has been coming from, you know, the elites, the well-funded people, and she's been getting large dollar amounts, but they've been from very few individuals considerably. So I'm interested to see kind of how that is going forward now that she has lost such a major funder, whether that will spur more grassroots individuals to invest in her campaign or not. So that's definitely one of the things I'm watching and seeing what happens there. So obviously both Trump and Haley were in Virginia this past week getting ready for Super Tuesday. I personally did not attend either of those events. So with the Haley team, they were actually unable to once again approve my request to cover one of their events as a member of the media. So this actually happened to me with the Haley team, I guess almost a year ago now. I think it was, 6 months ago. Last summer. I'm trying to remember the exact month. Gosh, really, in campaign season, everything blends together, to be completely honest. But the Haley team was not able to approve my request to cover one of their events last year. This was an event that she did in Arlington last year with the Susan B. Anthony list, when she was actually getting their endorsement. So last year, I had reached out a couple times to their official press contact for the campaign, and then I ended up reaching out to one of their campaign press people on Twitter. They were able to kind of get me an initial response, but I was actually unable to attend the event to cover it as a member of the media back then as well. And then this time, I only sent them one request, which they did not honor. Now, after they did not honor my previous request, they actually told me that they would let me know if she ever had any future events in Virginia and that they would keep me on her press list, which, as far as I know, I don't believe I'm still on her press list. I don't believe I ever was. You know, I was on the Trump team's list. I'm probably on a dozen different lists for them. I was on the Never Back Down PACs list. So for those that remember, that was obviously the group that was supporting Ron DeSantis. And, you know, I get media passes to cover events all the time. Like, speaking of Trump, I was at CPAC covering his speech there and kind of seeing all the support that he's getting from at least certain subsets of the Republican Party. But for some reason, I have not been had my, you know, credentialing requests approved by the Haley team, which, like, back when we were first talking about having a very robust Republican primary field in, you know, August and September and October, when these debates were going on, you know, I was willing to go into it. And there's probably at least two or three candidates that I was considering supporting and, you know, kind of giving them the benefit of the doubt, seeing exactly what they could come up with on stage. And, you know, I was pretty big fan of everything that Nikki Haley had done in her career. You know, for myself, for those that may not know, you know, personally, I'm also an immigrant. I'm obviously a woman, you know, active in Republican politics. There's kind of a lot of elements of her story that I really connected with, you know, growing up in a first generation immigrant household. And, you know, I respected a lot of the work that she did as ambassador. I enjoyed reading her book and hearing about kind of the ins and outs of the Trump administration and the role that she was able to play there as UN ambassador, and kind of really just followed her political career. You know, one of the things that she loves to tout is that she's never lost an election, you know, from state house up to governor, and again, all the work that she did in the Trump admin. So, you know, I've been a big fan of her story, but really the treatment that I've gotten from members of her team has honestly kind of left a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth, if I'm being totally honest. And yeah, you know, I think it's unfortunate because one of the things that I think people like to criticize Donald Trump and kind of his first administration on is that, like, he had a lot of people that had never worked in government. For conservatives, that's a pretty big selling point, that they, you know, weren't quote-unquote parts of the swamp and things like that. But that's, again, I think is something that Haley's really emphasized, is that she has a lot of people with very robust resumes working on her team and sort of really get that treatment. You know, obviously campaigning, as Jackie and I can both tell you, having worked on a handful of campaigns between each of us, and, you know, if you missed us talking about any of that, feel free to check out earlier episodes. But, you know, campaigning is obviously very different from governing, but I think a campaign is a very good test for how you and members of your team work under pressure, so that when you get to governing, you really know, again, kind of the ins and outs of individuals and things like that. And so, honestly, I probably expected a lot more from members of the Haley team, and I've been pretty, you know, I'd say disillusioned, disappointed, whatever words you want to use. But, you know, at least with the people that she has around her now, I don't know how that can lead to having a successful administration. So, you know, that's kind of how I'm feeling about her and the Republican primary so far. You know, at this point, I really don't see a scenario in which Donald Trump is not the nominee. So, yeah, that's definitely my two cents on the primary. Jackie, is there anything else you want to have me go over there, or do you want to hop over to the Democrats?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it is really interesting to hear your perspective. And I also agree. I mean, you know, always believe in a healthy, robust primary. And at the end of the day, of course, I wish that Donald Trump wasn't going to be the Republican nominee personally, but it's just been very hard for me to see that as, like, not what's going to happen. And especially at this point, I mean, I don't even think there's a, you know, I don't know the exact delegate count, but with a winner take all system here, like, is there even any, I don't even think there's really any path forward for Nikki Haley at this point. Is there?
Again, not really anything that I can think of. You know, obviously the Democrats have, like, super delegates and things like that. At least as far as I'm aware, that really doesn't exist on our side. So, you know, I think all these delegates are going to be bound as Trump delegates going into the RNC. So I think, again, at this point, we already know what's going to happen. I guess the only other scenario is, like, if there's more states that don't allow Donald Trump onto the ballot and how that could potentially impact things, or if he is found guilty in a court of law of any of the, you know, really dozen plus things that he's, like, on trial for.
Maybe I feel like we're going to need, like, a whole post-session, like, recap of everything that's gone on with those things.
Oh, for sure.
We haven't had time to talk about.
No, not at all. And so, you know, really, I think that's, like, the really the only thing that Haley's team is, like, holding out for is, like, if Donald Trump goes to jail. But, like, other than that, I have no idea why she's still in the race, to be completely honest with you.
Yeah, it is interesting. Wish you were able to get press credentials so you could ask her that question.
Well, exactly.
Maybe,
it's like,
maybe that's why they don't want you there.
Well, again, like, when I first reached out, like, you know, I work for one of the outlets that I work for is called the Republican Standard. So, like, of all the media that you could get there, at least, you know, 6 months ago or whenever that last event was, You know, I was willing to go in there with an open mind. I was willing to go in there and give her fair coverage. And the story that I ended up writing about the event was how I was denied access. And then at the very end, I said, oh, by the way, she got the endorsement and here's her stance. Like, the event was a pro-life event. So I'm like, you know, by the way, like, she's got a pretty decent record. You know, again, from the Republican perspective, like, she's got a very solid record on the issue. But I would have loved to have write a story about how that was and the endorsement and everything. And that's not the story they got out of that. And that was completely preventable. And again, I think when you talk about professionalism from people that have worked in politics for a large number of years, like, again, I know who some of the members of her team are, and they've got very good resumes working for very good members on Capitol Hill. At least as far as I know, actually, one of her press people is a former Trump press person from the 2020 cycle. So again, like, I think these people should know better. And again, I've frankly been pretty appalled at the handling of some of these things.
Well, that is sorry to hear. But yeah, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on how Tuesday progresses and see if that changes any bits of our conversation here about her chances moving forward.
Definitely. Well, I think we're at about time on this very exciting and kind of all over the place, but we had lots of things to cover episode. Do you want to go over our Democrat and Republican of the week?
Sure. In keeping kind of the theme of some of my favorite Republicans of the week, I will shout out some Republicans who took, you know, some potentially tough votes on some of the stuff that we talked about today, specifically on the marijuana one, which I think, as you and I have talked about, shouldn't really be a partisan issue, but unfortunately becomes one. And so I will shout out those two Republicans that you mentioned earlier, who were the only ones in each of their chamber to vote for the final version of the marijuana market legislation, which is Senator Kristi Newkrieg and Delegate Chris Obenshain. So shout out for taking a potentially, at least within your own caucus stance, but I hope your constituents, it's not a tough vote with your constituents, although, you know, of course, always rooting for a Democrat to take those seats, but if they're punished,
like, hopefully it doesn't cause you a primary challenger.
Hopefully this isn't hopefully this isn't the vote that causes you trouble. Shout out to Senator Craig and Delegate Obenshain.
Well, sweet. And my Democrat of the week comes from the federal side of things. So this is progressive or former progressive caucus member Richie Torres, Democrat from New York. I guess it was just over a week ago, but Jackie said I could use it, so I'm using it. So this is from February 21st, Axios article, progressive caucus member loses another, progressive caucus loses another pro-Israel member. It's all about Richie Torres being one of the most vocally pro-Israel Democrats in the House. He left the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Obviously, this is kind of one of the issues that I've really seen split the Democrat caucus, but honestly, even some Republicans, about you know, how everything is going on in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas and whether America should be supporting Israel or staying out of the issue. And so, you know, Torres has been one of those that's been very vocally pro-Israel. He had a public fallout with other members of the Progressive Caucus over their criticism of Israel. And Axios writes that he was, quote, quietly removed from the group's website between early December and mid-January. His departure was confirmed at Axios by a House Democrat and another source familiar with the matter. And spokespeople for both Torres and the Progressive Caucus apparently didn't respond to requests for comment that they had. And then Torres is the second member that this has happened to, or I guess has done this in recent months. The other one was Rep. Lois Frankel from Florida. She left the group in November after she voted to censure Rep. Rashida Tlaib of Michigan for an Israel aid bill that included IRS cuts. And again, obviously, as I'm sure most people are aware, Tlaib and other members of the Progressive Caucus, quote unquote, the squad, have strongly criticized Israel's military operations in Gaza.
Yeah, it is a rough issue, for sure. And, you know, I'll speak as a Democrat. Totally get why you're shouting him out this week. But yeah, as a Democrat, it is tough to watch these conversations and the lack of nuance that is going in there. Because I think it's a conversation that deserves a lot of nuance. But I don't think we have time to delve into all of that this week.
No, definitely not this week. Maybe on a future episode.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, it's good talking to you again. You know, this is the last week of session, so I think a lot of my time will be freed up in the next couple of weeks, and we can really delve into some of the stuff that's been going on both in Virginia and around the rest of the country.
Absolutely. And I guess final reminder for anybody that is listening to this on Monday or Tuesday, that's going to be Monday, March 4th or Tuesday, March 5th, go and vote. It is primary day, presidential preference primary for both parties. So go out, make your voice heard. On the Republican side, I believe we have 6 candidates on the ballot. The only ones that haven't dropped out are Trump and Haley. So go make your pick. And, you know, whether you're going out and voting for Trump, you know, be part of the group that supports him, or for Haley, go out and say you don't want Trump. So and you know, go and vote your conscience.
Same to the Democratic side. I voted early by mail because I figured it would be pretty hard for me to get out while in Richmond. So that was great. Shout out to our early vote laws that made that possible. You can choose between, on the Democratic side, Joe Biden, Marianne Williamson, and Dean Phillips. So early vote is over at this point, although if you still have a mail ballot for any party, as long as that is in the mail and postmarked by Tuesday the 5th, it will still be counted if it's received, I think, by Friday. So definitely turn that in. Or take your unused ballot with you when you go to vote on Election Day on Tuesday the 5th. And you can go to the Department of Elections page if you're not sure where you need to go to vote. You can check your registration on the, what's it called, the Department of Elections page. Oh, and we should also mention same-day voter registration. You can go register to vote at your polling place. And you can it'll be a provisional ballot that once it's confirmed and you are shown to be an eligible voter, it will be counted at that point. So lots of ways to make your voice heard. Better, you know, best to get in the habit of voting now during a primary so you remember what you're doing when it comes to November. And we have all of these races on the ballot.
Definitely November for everybody. And then obviously in June, we still have the primary. Do you guys also have a primary in June, or is that just us?
I think it just depends on where you are.
By district.
It'll be by district. As of now, I don't believe anybody is primarying my congressman, Don Meyer. But obviously, there will be some big Democratic primaries happening in to the top of my mind, CD7, which is currently held by Abigail Spanberger, who's running for governor, and then in CD10, currently held by Jennifer Wexton, who is, of course, retiring due to a terrible diagnosis. I should remember the full name at this point, and I don't, and that's my bad. We'll put the correct name in the show notes, but as she calls it, it's Parkinson's on steroids. And so, you know, she's in all of our thoughts and prayers as she kind of fights through this. But yeah, that'll be a big primary for who will step up to run to replace her on the Democratic side. And we'll definitely get more into those primaries after Super Tuesday and after session.
Definitely. And of course, on the Republican side, those are both seats that we hope to pick up. So we will also be having very robust primaries. So lots of opportunities to go out and vote and make your voices heard. So you can start by doing that on Tuesday. Or again, if you're mailing in your ballot, you can have it postmarked by Tuesday. So have a great rest of your week. Have fun voting if you haven't yet. And we will talk to you next time.
We'll talk to you next week. Talk to you later, Victoria.
Bye.